BadQuaker.com podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Thursday, December 13th, 2012. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 246. Today I want to talk about something that, directed history or accidental history. Now, this is not really conspiracy theory, although in a sense I'm going to touch on conspiracy theory. What I really want to distinguish is a difference between what I'm calling directed history, maybe some others have a different way of looking at directed history, and accidental history, meaning that there's, you know, pretty much no conspiracies of any kind. It's just, if you can consider the two, like, okay, if we think of directed history like the typical conspiracy theory way of thinking, we have this small committee of mostly men, central planning everything throughout history. I mean, these people are so brilliant. They control everything from, like, you know, like Israel's strategic defense to little girl's lemonade stand in Rapid Falls. And I mean, it's just it's fantastic, the thought that a small group of people could bring us the level of tyranny that we see all over the world. It's just I find it entirely, you know, it's just not plausible. And then the other version of history, the total accidental view of history, is just, we have layers and layers and layers of bumbling idiots in charge. These are our leaders, and they just constantly make the worst decisions possible. And they just constantly bumble into these idiotic situations. Like, I did a series on war, and I was talking about the build-up to Pearl Harbor. And if we just imagine, you know, here's Franklin Roosevelt in Washington, in D.C., and he's there in his office. And they've given him the memos that have all the outlines of all the plans that they knew that the Japanese were going to attack. And they knew right down to within time frames pretty accurately of when they were going to attack. And, he goes through and he says, well, let's see, what can we do? We can cut off their oil. We can cut off their steel. We can, you know, and each thing that he's doing is just, you know, if he's really wanting to stay away from war, he's doing the stupidest thing he can possibly do. And so you go through all this series of events that leads up to Pearl Harbor, and you come to the conclusion that either one of two things, either Franklin Roosevelt was doing everything he could to force the Japanese hand and cause them to feel like they had no choice other than to attack, or he's got to be like the stupidest man of the 20th century. You're left with these two options. So you can kind of see how you can kind of see my point that there's probably somewhere in the middle. He's probably trying to guide what he thought was the best to get the results that he wanted. Of course, what did he want? Well, that's debatable. He clearly wanted to get the U.S. into the war, and he had, you know, political connections with people in London, and there was I didn't go into a lot of the intrigue on that, but. But so you can see that it's probably, most of the events of history are probably a combination, because in the events with Japan attacking Pearl Harbor, there was clearly some bungling among the Japanese leaders. They mismanaged the situation. They overestimated their ability to harm the U.S. naval capabilities. They ended up putting all their effort and all their hopes and dreams into this one attack, and they failed to take out the carrier fleets. Well, if you fail to take out the carrier fleets, all you've done is really, you've just stomped on the toe of a really big giant, and that's really dumb. So there's bungling, sure, and there's probably equal bungling on all sides of these situations. So rather than just go and accept a direct idea of that history is the result of the plot of a small group of really super powerful men, or the opposite, that history is just a random collection of events that always seem to go in the same direction. Rather than accepting either of these, we can kind of look at history and realize that, you know, that people act. People act, and we're assuming sanity here. We're not assuming that, you know, that we're not going to buy the story that, you know, Hitler was this mad genius. No, he's not. He was just a man. We're not going to buy the story that somehow, you know, Napoleon was this mad genius. No, he was just a man. There's no indication that these people were actually insane. They had goals. They had, you know, they were wrong about some things. They were right about some things. But they're human beings. And you have layers and layers of people who propped them up over the years. They didn't just appear out of nowhere. These things, you know, if you have just one crazy person, you might be able to get a little cult around that person. But you're not going to get the control of an entire nation. It just doesn't make any sense. So what's more likely is that people tend to act on behalf of themselves. People tend to evaluate situations, and whether they're always right or not is not the point, but they tend to act on their own behalf. Even when people adopt a cause, some kind of greater, you know, some kind of greater cause than themselves, generally deep inside the root of the reason for them joining that cause or supporting that cause is because it makes them feel good to join that cause. So you have a person who, you know, who volunteers at some very noble thing. They volunteer to feed the poor, or they volunteer their time to do something very noble. Well, deep down inside, the person gets enjoyment in doing that. You feel good, and so you do that. There's a reward. There's a reward to charity that the person doing the charity, it makes them feel better. So in a sense, yes, they're doing it for a greater cause, but yet there's this selfish motivation too. I give a gift to someone because it makes me feel good. If it didn't make me feel good, I probably wouldn't do it. So humans act, and humans tend to act on our own behalf. And so now if we take this out a little bit wider, and you understand, you begin to understand how a person thinks and how they act if they believe in the myth of the state. If they believe that it's good for one group of people to be in control of a thing we call government, and for that one group of people to create laws and to take the wealth of working people and to support this thing we call government, and then inflict their laws upon everybody else. And these laws are not based on what's good for everybody. They're based on what's best for the government, for this organization. So if you have a person who believes that this is true, then they believe the myth of the state. And the core of statism is the idea that the believer is going to get more for themselves if the state exists than if the state doesn't exist. So, you know, whatever level that the person is involved or not involved with government, if they believe that through the existence of government, they get things like roads or protection or, you know, free cell phones or whatever it is that they think that they're going to have a net gain by the existence of government. If they didn't believe that, they wouldn't believe in government. They wouldn't believe the myth of the state. So the status on the core level is in it for their own good, just like the person who supports a charity, or just like the person who, you know, goes out and digs coal for a living. They're doing it because they're attempting to improve their situation. It's for themselves. And this is not saying that selfish is bad. This is saying that if it weren't for a person watching out for themselves, they wouldn't live. They wouldn't feed themselves. They wouldn't protect themselves. They wouldn't improve society at all. None of the things around us would be here. So striving to get something for yourself is not bad. And that's the core of why people believe in the state, because they believe ultimately that the existence of government is a net gain to them personally. Otherwise, they wouldn't believe in it. Now you think about, so a person who believes in the state then justifies the robbery through the government, through taxation, through money manipulation. They justify the robbery of government because they believe in the long run they're going to get more out of the deal for themselves. Now let's contrast this to the mugger. The difference between the mugger and the statist is that the statist has faith that that what's happening, that this robbery that's taking place, that a social good can come from this robbery. The mutual robbery of everybody will benefit everybody. That's the core of what the statist is believing. If everybody gets robbed, then everybody will be helped by it equally, right? Or at least some, at least I'll get helped more than I'll lose. That's the idea. Well, the mugger, the mugger has no such delusions. So, you know, so the statist feels good about the robbery. They can justify it morally to themselves. But the mugger doesn't try to lie to themselves like that. The mugger is the kind of a thief that's an honest thief. Sure, he's a thief, but at least he doesn't lie to himself about it. At least he doesn't say, well, I'm going out hitting old ladies over the head and stealing their purses to better society. See, he doesn't he's not delusional. He doesn't lie to himself like that. But the statist who says, yes, it's good for us to take this old lady's house so that we can build a new shopping center here, you see, because that's better for all of us. That disconnect with the consequences of your action is provided by the myth of the state. So the religion of statism provides a two-part, sort of a built-in reward for evil. It's like you have this immediate reward from the evil deed that you enjoy, and then you have the lie that when you do this evil thing, for the state, on behalf of the state, then a net good is accomplished for everybody. So you feel good about your deed no matter how evil it is. This is how self-selection bias drives individuals in government into specific jobs. So let's say a child molester will be driven to work with children, and that way they can do their evil deed and still feel good about it, because in the long run they feel like, oh, well, you know, my actions are not so bad, because, you know, the net gain is that I'm doing a good by working for the government as I molest these children. So, you know, you have him working there at the TSA, or you have him in Child Protective Services. One way or the other, you've now hired and promoted a child molester into a position that's perfectly suited for them, and then you reward them for that behavior. The guy who enjoys dominating the weak is going to be rewarded for his ability to dominate the weak. Not necessarily in the TSA, but it works there as well. It could be a cop, it could be, you know, anybody who really enjoys dominating other people. There are places in government that he's going to really excel in those positions. You might have the guy who hates his work. He hates all work. He doesn't want to do anything. He's very slothful. Well, he's going to fit in perfect in the layers of bureaucracy that is government. It's going to work out great for him. He's going to be able to go right in there. He's going to squat in a cubicle. He's going to almost never lift his fingers to do anything. Paperwork's going to come across his desk. He's going to be slow to respond to it. It's perfectly suited for that kind of a guy. Government work is perfectly suited for it. So people like that will be drawn into bureaucratic work. And that's exactly what we see in government. If you ever try to get anything accomplished with those people, that's what you run into. And then even the guy who doesn't want to be a part of government in any way, he wants to be a private businessman, or he wants to just work a job, or whatever it is, he's not necessarily wants to be a part of government, but he still believes that government provides a net good. So he makes excuses in his mind for the behavior and so forth, and he votes and he pays his taxes, or maybe he doesn't even bother voting. But one way or the other, he believes in his mind that government is good because he believes he's getting a net gain out of his relationship with government. Otherwise, he wouldn't want to do it. So now we see a system that doesn't actually require a central committee to function. Now, sure, most governments, as they exist today, have some type of a central committee. You might consider a parliament, or you might consider, you know, a president or a Congress or a dictator or a king or whatever. You consider that they do have a central committee. But if you look at the whole of government, you don't really need any kind of grand conspiracy. You don't really need a small committee of people with total control. The idea of government and the mythology of the state justifying government can exist even if you don't have some type of a scheme or a committee driving it on micromanaging every level of it, because the system itself will naturally put people into place in all the different levels from the top to the bottom who are all going to pretty much have the same goal, which is to make the government stronger and to actually serve the public less, because, you know, and to accomplish whatever it is, the little evil thing that they like to do, there's going to be this tendency for all those things to work without anybody micromanaging all those different levels. And, of course, it will grow. It'll get bloated. It'll get more and more, you know, invasive and intrusive, and it'll stomp on more and more people's toes. But that's kind of, you know, that's kind of inevitable. That's its design. Now, some people, even people who believe in this, in the system, even people who have great amounts of faith in the state, they're going to notice some cracks in this system. They're going to notice things going on that they don't necessarily approve of. But the faithful believer who sees that TSA agent and realizes that this is just an excuse to molest children, or this is just an excuse to dominate people, the faithful believer who sees that will have a tendency to make excuses in their mind and say, well, this is something we need to work on, or this is something that needs to be addressed. But overall, the system is good. Overall, government provides a net profit for all of us. This is what they believe. Otherwise, they wouldn't support it. So you have the local politician who might think that cops are thugs, and he might do everything he can to be as active in government at trying to, you know, work for the rights of people and control police brutality or whatever, you know, whatever his goals are. But deep down inside, he's entirely convinced that the system is good. It just needs to be tweaked a little bit. It's just got a few cracks. It just needs to be polished up a little bit. He doesn't question his faith in the state ever. When he sees a glitch like that, he has this desire to fix it, but he has no desire to end the process itself or to ever even examine the process. The process is of such a holy nature. It is lifted up so high in his mind, in his religion, that there's no way that he'll even begin to question the core of statism, the core of his religion. So, you know, an example of this was a great politician I used to love to watch him back before, you know, before he was in jail and so forth, was James Traficant. He was a House of Representatives representing the state of Ohio back a few years back. And he got arrested, I believe it was for racketeering and IRS for tax evasion or something like that, which was really ironic because Traficant made it his life's goal to just rail against the IRS and fight against the IRS, and he would stand on the House floor and go into these long rants about how evil the IRS was and how it needed to be closed down and how it had way too much power, and everything he was saying was right, except he still believed in the system. He still believed, he had 100% faith in his God, the state. You see, he just felt it needed to be tweaked. It just had this one thing that was wrong. He just wanted to tweak it a bit. Well, another example of that, just like with James Traficant, Will Grigg over at lewrockwell.com has put out a really good article today. It's there today at lewrockwell.com. And, you know, if you're hearing this in archives or whatever, I'll provide a link in today's show notes to Will Grigg's article. But in the article, he tells a story of a guy named John McLaughlin. And I'm going to just read the first couple of lines from Will's article just so you kind of get an idea. And this will just be a little teaser to try to get you over and read Will's whole article, because it's a really good article. It's not very long, but it's a really good article. So the article says, and this is the very beginning of the article, it says, John McLaughlin, known to his friends as Sparky, was a true believer in the war on drugs. He was convinced that his work as an agent of the Pennsylvania Bureau of Narcotics Enforcement was protecting innocent people from opportunists and thugs who prey on the weak. He eventually came to the sorrowful realization that the most ruthless elements involved in the drug trade aren't found in Latin America or blighted urban neighborhoods, but in well-appointed offices in Washington, D.C., and Langley, Virginia. You see, his investigations in trying to crack the drug trade ran him directly into the CIA that mostly controls the drug trade, especially on the big level. And Will's article is wonderful on this. It's really good, and you need to take a look at it. Okay, so I'm going to break now for the commercial, and when I get back, we'll take right back off again. Stick with me.
Admit it. You hate shopping for Christmas. You do. It's a hassle coupled with a burden, mechanically checking off friends, relatives, and coworkers from your list. You're probably not even religious, but if you are, is buying your cousin some little made-in-China piece of plastic really celebrating the birth of your savior? This holiday season, why buy gifts for friends and relatives? Most of them are status anyway. You should send that money to the Freedom Fiends instead. The Freedom Fiends will use your money to help spread education of horizontal liberation throughout the world. If you want to help provide inoculation from indoctrination, go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post to send your money to the Fiends instead. Because buying crap for unappreciative statist relatives won't get your name on the golden floppy disk of redemption. And if you must shop for Christmas, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you anything extra, and Amazon will save you the danger of holiday drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon pretty much sells everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed: The Road to Freedom, so get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com.
Okay, thanks for sticking with me. So we're talking about someone here who has a great amount of faith in the state, but they can see cracks in the process, in the system, and they know that they believe deep in themselves that these are just problems that can be fixed by more state, by more government. That their faith is so great in the state that they completely expect the answer to be in more government. So I'm thinking specifically of there's an Occupy meme for the Occupy Wall Street people, where there's a crowd of protesters and a crowd of cops, and they're clashing, and one of the protesters has his mouth wide open and he's screaming right at the cops, and right as the camera's taking the picture and he's screaming, there's a cop there with a can of pepper spray spraying him right in the face, and the caption says, it has an arrow pointing at the protester, and it says, wants more government. And then the other caption is pointing at the cop who's spraying the pepper spray in his face, and it says, is giving him more government. And this is really, a lot of people have kicked that around. It's a great meme. But that's really, just you can't explain it any better than that. That is exactly the mentality of the statist. They have 100% blind faith in the state and in the government, that the government is going to fix these cracks and these flaws. And how is it going to do it? By doing more of the same, by giving you more of what it's already giving you. And you can't really describe it as anything other than faith. It's just faith in a really, really silly religion. Now, I want to talk to you, shift gears just slightly here, and I want to talk to you about, I'm sort of going to tell you a story. The story of the king and the lender. Now, the lender sees the king and thinks that all he wants to do is waste wealth and waste life on war. That's how the lender sees the king. And the lender thinks, if we didn't have this stupid king, we wouldn't be at war all the time. Now, the lender still believes in government, don't get me wrong. He just blames the king. But, at the same time, he's making money off the king because the king is borrowing from him to wage the wars. Now, the king sees the lender as a tool so that he can gain more power. And why does he want more power? So he can stop the war. The king doesn't necessarily want the war. He wants the result of the war, which is more power to the king. You see, from the king's point of view, if he were the most powerful king, there'd be no war because nobody would challenge him. So this is his logic. So he thinks, if I'm strong enough, then nobody will challenge me and there'll be no war. But the lender sees it the opposite way around. Like, Like, if there was a way to have the government without the king, then there would be no war. So what am I going to do? Well, I'll finance the king till I come up with enough money that I can do good with my money. Now, consider this statement as I'm telling this story here. The myth of the state, taken to its logical end, must produce a one-world government, centrally planned and managed by the elite. Now, just consider that statement, and I'm going to work on the logic behind that as we go through the rest of that, but just consider the statement that the myth of the state, taken to its logical end, must produce a one-world government, centrally planned and managed by the elite. If you really believe that human beings should have a small group of human beings that dictate to everybody else what the laws are like and how to enforce those laws and how everybody's supposed to live, and that group of human beings should live off of the labor of other human beings, if you really believe that, then having multiple governments in the world creates the opportunity for war. The most peaceful, the most successful people would be, if this is true, if we believe this myth of the state, then the most successful process would be just one government controlling everything, one small committee of people making these decisions and everybody else doing as they say. If you really believe the myth of the state and you take it to its logical end, that's what you're left with. So then you can argue, how do you get there? Let's assume you believe this. Assume you believe the myth of the state. So then you can argue, how do we get there? Do we find the best king? Do we find the best emperor? Do we have elections? Is it through conquest? Can we just pick out one country and use that one to conquer all the other countries and come up with the country that we want? Well, ultimately, it doesn't matter, does it? Ultimately, if you believe in the core myth of the state that some humans should dominate other humans, then ultimately you have to believe that one government is better than two governments, because two governments could fight, three governments could fight, 10 governments could fight. But the likelihood of fighting reduces as the number of governments reduce. So two governments are less likely to fight than three. But one government wouldn't have anybody to fight. There would be no wars. So let's step back to the story of the king and the lender. So the lender finds a way to profit from the king's wars. Now, so the lender tells himself, okay, yeah, war is bad, but if I can make money on the king's wars, maybe I can do something good with this money. Maybe someday we won't even have to have a king. So then the lenders start to talk to each other. Now, is this a conspiracy? Do we think, oh no, if we're going to tell a story where the lenders talk to each other, you're just talking about conspiracy theories. Well, the kings talk to each other, don't they? Don't the ministers of the kings go and negotiate deals and work with each other and even sometimes conspire against each other? Don't kings do that? Well, why would we think that the lender wouldn't do that? So if we have in our story of the king and the lender, if we have the lender talking to other lenders, and they start to talk to each other, and it turns out they have the same ideas. You know, war is bad, but we're making a lot of money off of financing the king's wars. Well, what if there was some way to use that money for good? But all the while, they still believe in the myth of the state. Now, keep in mind that the state is bigger than any single government. The state is not just the government. The state is, financing the government is part of the state. When you are the financial wing that supports the government, whether you're private banking or whether you're a central bank that still can be private banking or it can be government owned, or if it's straight treasury from the government, whatever supports the financial processes of the government are part of the state. So in the modern state as we see it today, we have modern banking with fractional reserve banking. We have the modern corporate structure, modern corporations, and the government itself. And these three things together, with the mainstream media that gives the propaganda needed, and all the stuff coming out of Hollywood, we have the propaganda end, we have the industrial end with the control of the corporations, and we have the banking end with fractional reserve bankings, and we have the military end with government. So these things all are together to be the state, the myth that all these things are good. So as we think about the lenders, at some point in time, the king becomes cumbersome to the state. The king is just not necessary anymore. You know, government can function without the king. The corporations don't need the king. The bankers certainly don't need the king. And the bankers, you know, still believe maybe that, we're not using the word bankers. We're using the word lenders, aren't we? Okay, so the lenders still kind of think the wars are the fault of the king. So at some point, the king becomes cumbersome to the state, and the king's gone. The king is replaced by politicians, much more comfortable and easier to manipulate. So, you know, we have democracy, or at least the illusion of democracy. And this can be very convenient. It's very useful for the myth of the state to have this idea that, the politicians are there because we put them there. They represent us, right? There comes a time when the lenders control the money supply, and the lenders, through their use of control of the money supply, also control at least the major corporations. Now, once the lenders can control the money supply and the major corporations, then the politicians only hold the power that the illusion of democracy provides for them, because really the lenders own the politicians and control the voting process. And in this society that we're imagining here, the lenders even build machines that count the votes for the politicians. You see where we're at in this? Now, self-selection bias has created the lenders who control the money supply. The self-selection bias has pushed some people who are more successful into this business, into the money controlling business. Some people are far more successful at that, and so self-selection bias pushes those people into that industry. And eventually, the money lenders control the most powerful nations on the earth. You have essentially, at some point in this story, you would have one world government, and it wouldn't necessarily be a conspiracy. But it's the myth of the state taken to its logical end. You wouldn't necessarily have, a perfect socialistic committee controlling everything, but you would have a virtual version of that, even with separate countries, even with separate nations, with elections and politicians. If the point comes to where the entire money supply is controlled by the same lenders, and all the major corporations are owned by those same lenders, and then the politicians are pretty much in the pocket of those lenders who control the election, then you don't necessarily need one official government, because all the governments become a shadow of what it is that these lenders are trying to do. And what is it they're trying to do? Is it some horrible conspiracy where they're trying to take over the world and kill people? Well, not very likely. It's more likely that they believe in the state, and they're just trying to accomplish what it is that they believe. So it's not necessarily, you know, the word conspiracy literally comes from Latin words meaning something along the lines of under your breath, or like a whisper. It's a secret thing that's spoken under your breath. And an example of a conspiracy is a coup d'etat. Now, if we go with the definition of a coup d'etat, that is the sudden illegal deposition of a government, usually by a small group of existing establishment, to dispose the current government and take its place. The military historian Edward Lutwak gave us this definition. He said, a coup consists of the infiltration of a small but critical segment of the state apparatus, which is then used to displace the government from its control of the remainder. Now, I'll give you one example of such a conspiracy, such a coup, that worked. It actually did work, and this is, we can document this. It's not hard to do. One example of a conspiracy like that is the Constitution of the United States. Now, before you get too upset, if you haven't heard me talk about this before, or if you haven't heard some of the other people who have talked about this, stick with me just a minute here and let me explain what I mean by that. The Constitution of the United States was a planned conspiracy. It was a coup. It was a small group of people who took over the existing government, and they did so underhandedly. But they did so in a way that the existing government had really no choice other than war to do anything about it. And this is at a time when the people were very war weary. They had just gone through a war and they didn't want to deal with another one. Now, keep in mind, wars don't just pop out of nowhere. I've said this before when I was talking in the series on war. Wars don't just happen. Governments try to tell you that, like, we're just walking along one day, and all of a sudden, 9/11 happened. We got to go to war. Just walking along one day, all of a sudden, they attacked Pearl Harbor. Who knew? We got to go to war. Just walking along one day, and all of a sudden, the battleship Maine just exploded for no reason whatsoever. We have to go to war. You see, that's always the lie. But wars do not appear out of nothing. Wars are backed by money and power. We have the lenders and we have the kings. There's always a build-up to the war, and there's always something to gain and something to lose. And what's to gain and to lose is always more power for the king or whoever and more money for the lenders. That's always behind the war. So now, before the American War of Independence, both Washington and Hamilton had very powerful financial backers. And it's no secret that European, very wealthy Europeans, along with New York bankers, strongly supported going into the War of Independence. People with Washington, people like Fairfax, and people with Hamilton had all kinds of banking connections and supporters, both in New York and overseas. And generally speaking, these wealthy individuals, both in Europe and in New York, were attempting to compete with the East India Company. The East India Company was the first official corporation and was licensed by Elizabeth and signed into, you know, in 1600 and all that kind of thing. I've talked about that on other podcasts. So you have these people who were in opposition to the East India Company, and they were attempting to, create wealth without having to pay the East India Company every time they turned around for every little thing. They wanted to be able to compete on a more fair level, because of course the East India Company had the fist of the British government behind it. That's how it was so successful. So now, once the war got started, the War of Independence, Benjamin Franklin spent most of the war in France, securing money, securing arms, securing support for the war, and he did that through French, Dutch, and even English banking interests and aristocrats. Franklin knew he had all the connections in London, in Paris. He had all the connections. And, and he was a slick-tongued guy. So, what did Murray Rothbard, I think Murray Rothbard called him the old deceiver or something like that, I can't remember the phrase. I wish I would have remembered that or written it down. Anyway, so basically Franklin was going to people who had profited from the Hundred Years' War, which England and France had been in the Hundred Years' War. And so Franklin was going to people who had profited dramatically from those wars and was securing financing for the War of Independence back in the Americas. And he was an expert at it. He was a very bright man. We can be argued his morals, but I don't think anybody would attack Franklin's intelligence. And he was certainly a winner of hearts. So that was his job. His job was to get money from people who had profited in the Hundred Years' War, and prop up another war, essentially against the East India Company. Now consider a guy Lafayette. I don't like to use titles and so forth. I slip and put out a title every now and then, but Gilbert Lafayette, most people don't know him by that name. They want to call him the Marquis, but Gilbert Lafayette was one of several French aristocrats of immense wealth, and he brought his own private army and along with navies from other aristocrats, other French aristocrats that came with him. And they came over and joined the colonials in their war. This is, Cornwallis at Yorktown. When he surrendered at Yorktown, he was faced by French armies on land and the French navy at sea. had blockaded him in. Well, that was Lafayette and his aristocrat friends, basically. And this was, speaking of Cornwallis, and the same with Lafayette, there's an interesting way that they profited from war, people like this. First, as a young person, they would get a commission into the military or the Navy. And then they would, as a rich person, they would get authorized to raise a regiment. Or in the Navy, you would, you know, it would be involved with shipbuilding and so forth. But, okay, so then they would get a government authorization to raise a regiment. And then they would, once they would raise the regiment, then they would get paid by the government to use their regiment on behalf of the government. So it was government military. The pay was coming from the government, but the rich guy actually owned that company. And it's literally, armies were companies. It was a profitable business for somebody like Cornwallis or Lafayette. So literally his company made business for him, and Cornwallis was a part of the East India Company. So his soldiers were technically English British soldiers, but at the same time they were his company. He used that company to make profits, not only in getting paid by the English government, but also in any looting that they could accomplish at the same time. Okay, when I get back from the break, I'm going to talk some more about this. Hang with me, I'll be right back. Did you know author Taryn P. Lupo has a new novel out called One Nation Under Blood? When a rejuvenative blood technology is developed that pits the young against the old, the government must take firm steps to address the war of supply and demand brewing across generational lines. Blood is not the only thing bought and sold in this dystopian tale of technology, economics, and independence. Vampires are now very real, but we never expected them to wear our grandmother's best Sunday dress. The Bad Quaker staff has discovered how easy it is to get everything you need for the holidays at Amazon. Everything from the coolest decorations to hangover remedies, and everything from the latest movies and music to poop stain remover. If you follow the Amazon link at badquaker.com, Amazon will give badquaker.com a tiny portion of the purchase. It won't cost you any extra, but you will be supporting this podcast. Thank you. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. Now, I was talking about Gilbert Lafayette, or the so-called Marquis. I'm sure his mother probably didn't pronounce it Gilbert. She probably pronounced it Gilbert. But either way, he came from a very interesting family. Lafayette's ancestor was, and actually his namesake, the man he was named after, was a champion of arms who led Joan of Arc's army at Orleans. So his family has a very rich history of getting rich from war. Another of Lafayette's ancestors, it's said that he acquired the Crown of Thorns during the Sixth Crusade. He profited immensely from the Crusade and supposedly brought back the Crown of Thorns. I can kind of imagine, you know, some guy in Palestine, and here come all these French knights, you know, stomping around, sort of imagine like a sort of a Monty Python type scenario, and some local craftsman is there, you know, making this or that, and he's got some thorns that he had pulled off of a locust tree or something, and they're laying around there, and he says, "Yeah, I got an idea." And so he sells old man Lafayette the Crown of Thorns. And what do you know? Turns out there's a pretty good profit in this kind of job. Maybe selling chunks of the cross would make some money too. Anyway, so I won't go in that direction. So war is profitable for some. War produces power for the king, power for, you know, the politicians, but it produces money for the right people. If you're on the right side of war, war produces vast levels of wealth. Of course, if you're on the wrong side of war, well, that's not so good. Well, after the War of Independence, basically the independent states, the 13 independent states, not all of them, but many of them, fell into using script or paper money, because there wasn't a whole lot of hard currency in the former colonies. Now, also, the Continental Army, you know, a good portion of the Continental Army was paid in script, in promissory notes. Some were paid in land grants, and some weren't paid at all. Some units of the Continental Army were promised, you know, you'd keep fighting. At the end of the war, everybody's going to get paid. You're going to have so much money, you won't believe it. You're just going to we're going to pay you like crazy once this war is over. And then they didn't get paid. They come out of the war. The war's over, and then they're told by the state government that their farm, that they have to pay back taxes on their farm, property taxes. Well, in many of these situations, they had never had property taxes before. Property tax for a lot of these people was a brand new thing, with these new states. It didn't exist under the colonies. Now, there were some situations with quit rent where a landlord owned the land and tenants paid the landlord to stay on the land. But before the War of Independence, if you owned land outright, you did not pay property taxes, at least in most of the colonies. So this new property tax was a shock to a lot of these people coming out of the Continental Army. And in many cases, the states would either charge them back taxes for years while they were actually fighting in the war, or the confusion of this new tax being on them wouldn't become apparent for a couple of years. And so before they realized that they really owed it, they would be 3 or 4 years behind. And so either way, you created a situation where these farmers that were barely making it, especially out on the western edges of the new states, the farmers out in the western edges didn't make a lot of money anyway. So now all of a sudden they've got to pay 2, 3, 4, 5 years in back taxes to the state, and of course the only money floating around is paper money, and there really quickly became a problem of merchants, and especially bankers and European merchants that were trading with the American merchants. More and more, they wouldn't take the scrip. They wanted real gold and silver. And this put the farmers in a very bad situation. And you know, they weren't making any money, and yet they still had to pay their taxes. And all they had was the old scrip that they'd been paid for their Continental Army service. And that had become pretty much useless. The inflation was so bad because they had overproduced the money, and like governments do. And so there was this money scam that was developing. And so insiders who kind of had a knowledge that something's going to take place here, insiders bought that script for almost nothing. The farmers were absolutely desperate to get real gold and silver, because, you know, they were in the process of losing their farms. Again, insiders would watch the tax situation, and they would go in and grab up the land from the farmers and pay off the tax bills. And some of the new states would actually take the script for the taxes, and some wouldn't. So these money manipulators were taking advantage of this situation with this paper money scam. And why would they do this? Why would they buy useless paper money that nobody wanted? Why would they give up gold and silver for useless paper money? Well, they knew something. There was a plan. There was a conspiracy. And it's not really that hard to find the real, not just evidence, but proof of this conspiracy. If you start looking at Hamilton, and you start looking at his personal letters, and you start looking at Washington, and you start looking at what they were doing during this time. So right down in the middle of all this, you have these farmers, many of them veterans of the war, that are losing their farms, literally starving, and out of all this, Shays' Rebellion breaks out. Now, so what was Shays' Rebellion? Was it a random event, or was it a contrived excuse? We go back to our, you know, guided history or random events of history just happening. Well, I would say, you know, the old phrase, never let a crisis go to waste. I would say that Shays' Rebellion was predictable. Maybe it wasn't intentional, but it was predictable. You start starving farmers and taking their land, something's going to happen. So it's predictable in that sense. But once it happens, then you don't want to let a crisis like that go to waste if you're a good statist. And there were accusations at the time by Samuel Adams and by others that there were European interests behind Shays' Rebellion on both sides, pushing it to happen and pushing the starving farmers into rebellion and even supporting them at times. So now we have a situation where weak governments controlled the states, and a lot of inconsistent statists want a small, weak government to control government. But those statists are inconsistent. If they really believe that government was good, then why wouldn't you want more of it? If it's good, more would be better, right? So if they really believe that government should be small and limited, why do you believe that? Because it's evil? Then why do you want it at all? Well, some months before the Continental... Oh, I should mention, too, the Shays' Rebellion happened... it started right after a Continental Convention, and it went its full length and ended before the next scheduled Continental Convention. So it was going to be a topic of discussion during the Continental Convention, and this is basically a get-together under the rules of the Articles of Confederation. And so it was going to be a topic of discussion for certain. That was a big event that took place. Well, some months before the upcoming Continental Convention, George Washington wrote a letter to Henry Lee attempting to win him over to Washington's side in the argument of big, strong government or small, weak government. And so I'm going to read to you exactly what Washington wrote to Henry Lee. Henry Lee was a very powerful influence on independence and on, he was like a Jeffersonian type, really striving for liberty and so forth. So Washington says this. He says, "You talk, my good sir, of employing influence to appease the present tumulus in Massachusetts. I know not where this influence is to be found, or, if attainable, that it would be a proper remedy for the disorder. Influence is not government. Let us have a government by which our lives, liberties, and properties will be secure. Or, let us know the worst at once." Okay, now this last part of the line there, "Influence is not government. Let us have a government by which our lives, liberties, and properties will be secure, or let us know the worst at once." In other words, well, let's see, how would you take that? As a threat? As an ultimatum? If George Washington, a military man, a man known to tend in that direction, and Henry Lee, a politician... if you were sent a letter like that by Washington in reference to Shays' Rebellion that just happened and the upcoming Continental Convention, would you take that as an ultimatum or as a threat? How would you look at a wording like that? Well, just to kind of contrast George Washington's view and George Washington's desire to have a powerful federal government, think about how Jefferson responded to the same events in the same time frame. He wrote this very famous couple lines here. He said, "The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants." He said, it is its natural manure. So now we have two different ways of looking at Shays' Rebellion. We have Washington saying, because of this, we need a strong federal government, and... Henry Lee, you better agree with me. And then we have Jefferson saying, well, you know, a little rebellion is good now and then. As a matter of fact, that's the line that he said just prior to the refreshed line. He said, a little rebellion is a good thing now and then. And then he went on to say that the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. So we see the two different views of Shays' Rebellion, from Jefferson to Washington. But the deal was, Jefferson was in France at the time of the Continental Convention. And from France, because of communications of the day, no communication could reach Jefferson, then him respond to it, and it go back to the Continental Convention while the Continental within the time frame that they had at the Continental Convention. So Jefferson was left in a position of absolutely no influence on the Continental Convention. So now, I mentioned a coup. And I mentioned that one conspiracy that worked, a coup, was the Constitution of the United States. Well, let me outline that a little bit. A meeting was called to adjust the Articles of Confederation. Now, that was the Continental Convention that was upcoming. It was supposed to be from May, probably May till September. It ended up being May 25th to September 17th, 1787. All right, so now most of the delegates who had been selected to represent their states didn't believe the Articles of Confederation had failed. They didn't believe they were meeting to form a new government. They believed that they were meeting like they had met at the last Continental Convention to talk about any kind of problems that might come up, make any kind of adjustments that need to be made, and continue under the Articles of Confederation. This story, this lie, this tale that the Articles had failed was an invention after the fact to cover the overthrow of the existing government. At that time, a select group of Federalists met 22 days prior to the Continental Convention. They took control of the hall, and they guided the overthrow of the 13 separate states. Washington joined this conspiracy on May 13th, 12 days before the official convention. And keep in mind, Washington was not a delegate. He was not sent there by his state of Virginia. He simply showed up in military uniform and took over. This is what is called a coup d'etat. That's the definition of a coup d'etat. We have a military leader and a select group, not the whole of the body of the delegates, the ones who showed up earlier, the ones who showed up up to, what was it, 22 days earlier. They showed up before the body of the politicians showed up. They showed up, they formed the Constitution, they elected George Washington as their leader, and when the rest of the when the rest of the delegates arrived on May 25th, they had already taken control and the coup was done. The government was kicked out and the new government was put in. This is the very definition of a coup d'etat. Along with Jefferson, Thomas Paine was in France at the time. So two of the loudest statesmen who could have spoke against this were out of the country at the time. Patrick Henry refused to have anything to do with the Continental Convention. He refused to attend the convention. And he even went so far as to say, in reference, he said he smelt a rat in Philadelphia, and that's why he didn't want to go down there and deal with them. He was bitterly opposed to this new constitution. George Mason, another of the great, considered so-called founding fathers, was also bitterly opposed to this constitution. Now, George Mason, unfortunately, in order to try to keep the peace, because like I said, they had just come out of years of war, and so George Mason, in an attempt to compromise and keep the peace, insisted that, okay, if you're going to do this constitution, if you're going to shove this thing down our throat, then at least do this. At least let us put amendments onto it. And so that's how the Bill of Rights got added, was through George Mason and some of the others insisting that if you're going to shove this down our throats anyway, at least let's put this disclaimer on it. So then, do we have here directed history or accidental history? Do we have a small group of conspirators? Well, in the case that we're just now talked about, in the case of the War of Independence, we do have a small group of conspirators, and they were in opposition to the East India Company, you know, the famous Boston Tea Party. Well, who do you think owned that tea? Whose ships were those? Those were East India Company ships, and that was East India Company tea that was being dumped in the harbor. This was a war of companies, of corporations. Okay, so we have a small group of conspirators that start the war. It has mysterious funding mostly from Europe and from financiers in New York that have connections in Europe, and some of them even in London. And so we have the rebels winning the war, not really rebels, but we have the Americans winning the war, but they didn't really gain any real power out of it because they ended up with this loose confederation of weak states. And so then this paper money scam is created, and a very select group of people understand how to manipulate this money scam and make huge profits off of it. If there's a central government that comes into play, and if there's a central banking that comes in and pays and buys out all this script, then this small group of people will make a lot of money. And what do you know? There's a coup. There's a powerful government that takes over. They slam into place a central bank that buys up all the script, and a small group of people make a huge amount of money. And then what happens when they're done? Well, like with Lafayette, what did Lafayette do? Well, he immediately went to France and started a revolution over there, got himself arrested, and Napoleon had to get him out of jail, as a matter of fact. So what do? Some of them stay in the newly formed U.S., take advantage of the power and the money. Others go to France and you know, it's like, start a revolution there. Just repeat what you just did. It worked here. Why wouldn't it work there? And that was exactly what they did. So now we have a look at the world today, and we start to look around and we say, well, if conspiracies, now we're not necessarily talking about, the New World Order or evil Rothschilds or whatever, but we can see that groups of people get together and discuss things and arrange things for their own benefit. And if you have people who believe in the state, they already believe that government is a good thing, and then they can find out that they actually can make money off of these ventures, well, then they tend, self-selection bias tends to push people into positions where they have the power to do these things. And so we don't necessarily need, all the wild conspiracy theories to realize that history, at least to a certain extent, is guided. History does have a direction that it's going. And again, if you look at it even further and you realize that governments, especially in the last 100 years, have very consistently gone in one direction. All the, more and more power toward the banking elite. The banking elite supporting very select corporations who are becoming far more powerful than their competitors, and more, left and right politicians in more countries are arguing more bitterly over every little minuscule idea that they can argue with each other about, but they don't really do anything to change anything. The argument continues, but nothing ever changes. And then more and more countries that are not in their control, like, for instance, countries that are not in the control of these bankers and these corporations. Well, let's see, who would that be? Well, I don't know. In the year 2000, the government of Afghanistan stopped all poppy production, killed the heroin trade. And remember what I was talking about with Will Grigg a minute ago? And the CIA controls the heroin trade. So all of a sudden, the CIA's cash cow in Afghanistan dries up and can't give any more milk. Well, that's funny, because the very next year, the U.S. invaded, and immediately the poppy trade came back, and the CIA got its heroin trade back. Funny thing, too, happened in the year 2000. Iraq converted all of its oil transactions over to euros. Iraq did that in the year 2000. And then right away, there's all these lies that take the U.S. into war with Iraq. Totally random event, right? Okay, and then in 2008, Iran suddenly became the bad guys. Iraq was in control, but we had to fear Iran. Iran's going to do something crazy. They're going to kill Israel. They're going to do this. They're going to do that. Well, it turns out that, oddly enough, the same year in 2008, when Iran became the bad guy of the day, was the same year that Iran stopped taking U.S. dollars for oil and started moving towards other currencies outside of the banking controls of the lenders. And the funny thing happened again, we have a change of politicians. The evil war criminal George Bush is out, and now the peace president is in. Obama, the peace president, benevolent Obama, is now the president. And funny thing happened, Libya was relatively prosperous and peaceful and not really bothering anybody before the revolution. And then, according to the IMF, Libya's central bank had about 144 tons of gold in its vaults. And right about that time, Gaddafi lays out this proposal to introduce a gold dinar for African countries. And at the time, the Central Bank of Libya was 100% state-owned. The lenders were not there. And the U.S. dollar had to be converted to the Libyan dinar to buy oil from Libya. Well, Obama couldn't put up with that, now could he? But that's not a conspiracy, is it? That's not guiding history, is it? That's just random events, right? These things are unconnected. They just happen out of nowhere, right? Folks, thanks for listening today. And remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.